Chapter 1. From the window, all that could be seen was a receding area of grey. It was to be supposed that beyond the grey garden, which seemed to sprout nothing but the stiffish leaves of some unfamiliar plant, lay the vast grey lake, spreading like an anaesthetic towards the invisible further shore. And beyond that, in imagination only, yet verified by the brochure, the peak of the Dendoche, on which snow might already be slightly and silently falling. For it was late September, out of season. The tourist had gone. The rates were reduced, and there were few inducements for visitors in this small town at the water's edge, whose inhabitants, uncommunicative to begin with, were frequently rendered taciturn by the dense cloud that descended for days at a time and then vanished without warning to reveal a new landscape full of colour and incident. Boats skimmed on the lake, passengers at the landing stage, an open-air market, the outline of the gaunt remains of a 13th century castle, seams of white on the far mountains, and on the cheerful uplands to the south, a rising backdrop of apple trees, the fruit sparkling with emblematic significance. For this was the land of prudently harvested plenty, a land which had conquered human accidents, leaving only the weather distressingly beyond control. Edith Hope, a writer of romantic fiction under a trusting name, remained standing at the window as if an access of goodwill could pierce the mysteriously opacity with which she had been presented. Although she had been promised a tonic cheerfulness, a climate devoid of illusion, an utter, commonsensical, not to say pragmatic, set of circumstances, quiet hotel, excellent cuisine, long walks, lack of excitement, early nights, in which she could be counted upon to retrieve her serious and hard-working personality and to forget the unfortunate lapse which had led to this brief exile in this apparently unpopulated place at this slowly darkening time of year when she could have been at home. But it was home, or rather home, which had become inimical all at once, and that she had acquiesced, rather frightened at what was happening to her, when her friends had suggested a short break and had allowed herself to be driven to the airport by her friend and neighbour, Penelope Mion, who, tight-lipped, was prepared to forgive her only on condition that she disappeared for a decent length of time and came back older, wiser, and properly apologetic. "For I am not to be allowed my lapse, as if I were an artless girl," she thought. "And why should I be? I am a serious woman who should know better, and am judged by my friends to be past the age of indiscretion. Several people have remarked upon my physical resemblance to Virginia Woolf. I am a householder, a rate payer, a good plain cook, and a deliverer of typed scripts well before the deadlines. I sign anything that is put in front of me. I never telephone my publisher, and I make no claims to my particular sort of writing, although I understand that it is doing quite well. I have held this rather dim and trusting personality together for a considerable length of time, and although I have certainly bored others, I was not to be allowed to bore myself. My profile was deemed to be low, and it was agreed by those who thought they knew me that it should stay that way. And no doubt, after a curative stay in this grey solitude, and I notice that the leaves of the plants are quite immobile, I shall be allowed back to resume my peaceful existence and to revert to what I was before I did that apparently dreadful thing. Although, frankly, once I had done it, I didn't give it another thought. But I do now, yes. Turning her back on the toneless expanse beyond the window, she contemplated the room, which was the colour of overcooked veal, veal-coloured carpets and curtains, high narrow bed with veal-coloured counterpanes, small austere table with a correct chair placed tightly underneath it, a narrow, costive wardrobe, and, at a very great height above her head, a tiny brass chandelier, which, she knew, would eventually twinkle drearily with 8 weak bulbs. Stiff white lace curtains provided even more protection against the sparse daylight, could be parted to allow access through long windows to a narrow strip of balcony on which were placed a green metal table and chair. I shall be able to write there when the weather is fine, she thought, and moved to her bag to extract 2 long folders, one which contained the first chapter of Beneath the Visiting Moon, on which she planned to work calmly throughout this curious hiatus of her life. But it was to the other folder that her hand went. On opening it, she moved instinctively to the table and was soon seated on the unyielding chair, her pen uncapped, her surroundings ignored. "My dearest David," she wrote, "a cold coming I had of it." Penelope drove fast and kept her eyes grimly ahead, as if escorting a prisoner from the dock to the maximum security wing. "I was disposed to talk. It is not every day that I get on an aeroplane, and the pills I had got from the doctor had the effect of making me rather loquacious. But my interventions did not seem to be too welcome. Anyway, she relented once we were at Heathrow and found me a trolley for my bag and told me where I could get a cup of coffee, and suddenly she was gone, and I felt terrible. Not sad, but light-headed, and rather entertaining, and with no one to talk to. I drank my coffee and paced around and tried to absorb all the details, as people think writers do, except you, my darling, who never think about it at all. And suddenly I caught sight of myself in the glass and the ladies, and saw my extremely correct appearance and thought, I should not be here. I am out of place. Milling crowds, children crying, everyone intent on being somewhere else, and here was this mild-looking, slightly bony woman in a long cardigan. Distance, inoffensive, quite nice eyes, rather large hands and feet, meek neck, not wanting to go anywhere, but having given my word that I would stay away for a month until everyone decided that I was myself again. For a moment I panicked, for I am myself now, and was then, although in fact was not recognised. Not drowning, but waving. Anyway, I got over that, though it was not easy, and joined the most terrible set of people I could find, knowing, without bothering to ask, that they were bound to be going to Switzerland. And very soon I was on the plane, and a quite charming man sat next to me and told me about this conference he was attending in Geneva. I deduced that he was a doctor. In fact, I had him down as a specialist in tropical diseases, particularly as he told me that he did most of his work in Sierra Leone. But it turned out that he had something to do with tungsten. So much for my novelist's famed powers of imagination. Nevertheless, I felt a bit better, and he told me about his wife and daughters, and how he was flying back to them in 2 days' time to have a weekend at home before he goes back to Sierra Leone. And within an extraordinarily short time, we were there. I notice that I say there and not here. And he put me in a taxi, and after about 1.5 hours, I ended up here. And it is the beginning to be here rather than there. And very soon, I shall have to unpack and wash and tidy my hair and go downstairs and try to find a cup of tea. The place seems to be deserted. I noticed only 1 elderly woman as I came in, very small, with a face like a bulldog, and legs so bowed that they seemed to throw herself from side to side in an effort to get ahead, but doing so with such grim conviction that I instinctively got out of the way. She walked with a stick and wore one of those net veils on her head, covered with small blue velvet bows. I had her down as a Belgian confectioner's widow, but the boy carrying my bags nodded vestigially and murmured, "Madame la Comtesse," as she rocked past. So much for the novelist's famed powers, etc. In any event, I was processed so speedily into this room, almost induced into it, that I couldn't take in anything else. It seems quite warm, fairly spacious. The weather might, I suppose, be described as calm. I think about you all the time. I try to work out where you are, but this is rather difficult, surrounded as I am by the time change, minimal thoughts it is, and the lingering effect of my pills and all those sad cypresses. In a manner of speaking, but tomorrow is Friday, and when it begins to get dark, I shall be able to imagine you getting into the car and driving to the cottage, and then, of course, the weekend, about which I try not to think. You cannot know. At this point, she put down her pen and massaged her eyes briefly, sitting for a moment with her elbows on the table and her head bent into her hands. Then, blinking, she took up her pen again and continued her letter. Ridiculous to tell you to take care of yourself, because you never think of all the mild precautions that others take. And in any case, there is nothing I can do to make you. My dear life, as my father used to call my mother, I miss you so much. She remained seated at the table for a few minutes, then took a long breath and put the cap back on her pen. Tea, she thought. I need tea. And then a walk, a very long walk, along the lake shore. And then a bath, and change into my blue dress. And by that time, I shall be ready to make the entrance, always so difficult to negotiate, into the dining room. And then there is all the business of the meal to get through, which will take a bit of time, and after that I shall sit around and talk to someone. It hardly matters to whom, if only to the bulldog lady. And I need an early night, so that it won't be too bad. In fact, I'm quite tired already. She yawned until her eyes watered and then stood up. Unpacking took a few minutes. Superstitiously, she left the bulk of her clothes in her bag, signifying to herself that she could be off in a few minutes if the chance arose, although knowing that everything would stay there and be hopelessly creased into the bargain. It had ceased to matter. Her hairbrush, her nightgown, were carried to the bathroom. She surveyed her appearance, which seemed to be no different, and then, retrieving bag and keys, she stepped into the corridor, vibrant with absence. A pale light flickered through a large window over the landing. The wall seemed to be enshrined, a distant memory of substantial meals. There was nobody about, although through a door further along the corridor, she could hear the faint sound of a radio. The Hôtel du Lac, Famille Hubert, was a stolid and dignified building, a house of repute, a traditional establishment used to welcome the prudent, the well-to-do, the retired, the self-effacing, the respected patrons of an earlier era of tourism. It had made little effort to smarten itself up for the passing trade, which it had always despised. Its furnishings, although austere, were of excellent quality, its linen spotless, its service impeccable. Its reputation among knowledgeable professions attracted apprentices of good character who had a serious interest in the hotel trade. But this was the only concession it made to a recognition of its own resources. As far as guests were concerned, it took a perverse pride in its very absence of attractions, so that any visitor mildly looking for a room would be puzzled and deflected by the sparseness of the terrace, the muted hush of the lobby, the absence of piped music, public telephones, advertisements for scenic guided tours, or notice boards directing one to the amenities of the town. There was no sauna, no hairdresser, and certainly no glass cases displaying items of jewellery. The bar was small and dark, and its austerity did not encourage people to linger. It was implied that prolonged drinking, whether for purpose of business or as personal indulgence, was not comme il faut. and, if thought absolutely necessary, should be conducted either in the privacy of one's suite or in a more popular establishment where such leanings were not unknown. Chambermaids were rarely encountered after 10 o'clock in the morning, by which time all household noises had to be silenced. No vacuum cleaning was heard. No curls of dirty linen were glimpsed after that time. A discreet rustle announced the appearance of the maids to turn down the beds and tidy the rooms once a guest had finished changing to go down to dinner. The only publicity from which the hotel could not distance itself was the word-of-mouth recommendation of patrons of long standing. What it had to offer was a mild form of sanctuary, an assurance of privacy, and the protection and the discretion that attaches themselves to blamelessness. This last quality being less than attractive to the surprising number of people, the Hôtel du Lac was usually half empty, and at this time of year, at the end of the season, was resigned to cater for a mere handful of guests before closing its doors for the winter. The few visitors who were left from the modest number who had taken their decorous holidays and high summer months were, however, treated with the same courtesy and deference as if they were treasured patrons of long standing, which, in some cases, they were. Naturally, no attempt was made to entertain them. Their needs were provided for and their characters perused with equal care. It was assumed that they would live up to the hotel standard, just as the hotel would live up to theirs. And if any problems were encountered, those problems would be dealt with discreetly. In this way, the hotel was known as a place which was unlikely to attract unfavourable attention, a place guaranteed to provide a restorative sojourn for those whose life had mistreated or merely fatigued. Its name and situation figured in the card index of those businesses it is to know such things. Certain doctors knew it, many solicitors knew it, brokers and accountants knew it. Travel agents did not know it or had forgotten it. Those families who benefit from the periodic absence of one of those more troublesome members treasured it, and the word got around. And of course it was an excellent hotel, and its situation on the lake agreeable. The climate not brilliant, but in comparison with other similar resorts it was equitable. The resources of this little town were not extensive, but carts could be hired, excursions could be taken, and the walking was pleasant, if unexciting. The scenery, the view, the mountains were curiously unemphatic, as if delineated in the watercolours of an earlier period. Whilst the young of all nations hurtled off to the sun and the beaches, jamming the roads and the airports, the Hôtel du Lac took a quiet pride, and sometimes it was very quiet indeed, in its isolation from the herd, knowing that it had a place in the memory of its old friends, knowing too that it would never refuse a reasonable request from a new client, provided that the new client had the sort of unwritten references required from a hotel of this distinction, and that the request had come from someone whose name was already on the Hubert's family files, most of which went back to the beginning of the century. As she descended the wide, shallow stairs, Edith could hear well-behaved laughter echoing some sort of salon where she supposed tea to be in progress. And then as she approached, as if drawn to the sound, a sudden, furious barking, high-pitched, peevish, boding ill for future peace. At the foot of the stairs crouched a very small dog, quivering with anxiety, its eyes covered by its hair. When no one came to see what was wrong, it started up again at full volume, but experimentally like a baby. A prolonged keening, as if it were undergoing unimaginable torture, brought cries of, "Kiki, kiki, naughty dog!" And a tall woman of extraordinary slenderness and with the narrow nodding head of a Griba rushed out of the bar, collapsed at the foot of the stairs, gathered the dog into her arms, covered it with kisses, and again with the same boneless, uncoiling movement, pressed the dog to her face like a cushion and returned to the bar. A puddle on the last step brought a momentarily closing of the eyes and a quick snap of the fingers from the manager. As a boy in a white jacket, wielding a cloth impassively, as if this happened fairly often, the manager of the Hôtel du Lac, Famille Hubert, indicated to Edith Hope his distress that this incident should mar her arrival, and at the same time express dissociation from the misdemeanours of animals and, more importantly, from those unwise enough to harbour them. For the latter, he would, of course, provide shelter, but shelter without complicity. How interesting, thought Edith. That woman was English, and such an extraordinary shape, probably a dancer, and she promised herself to think about this later. The salon was agreeable than her room would have led her to expect, furnished with a deep blue carpet, many round glass tables, comfortably traditional armchairs, and a small upright piano at which an elderly man with a made-up bow tie was playing mild selections from post-war musicals, with tea inside her and a slice of excellent cherry cake, Edith plucked up the courage to look around. The room was sparsely populated. She supposed that most people would only come back for dinner. The pug-faced lady was eating grimly, her legs wide apart, crumbs falling unnoticed onto her lap. Two shadowy men were whispering in the far corner. A greyish couple, man and wife, or brother and sister, were checking their air tickets, and the man, who had by no means finished his tea, was set off periodically to see if the car had arrived. Although the room was bright and cheerful, its most notable feature was its air of deadly calm. Edith recognised the fate to which she had been consigned, sighed, but reminded herself that this was an excellent opportunity to finish beneath visiting moon, although it was not an opportunity that she herself had sought. When she next raised her eyes from her book, a book from which she hadn't absorbed not a single word, it was to find an unexpected note of glamour in the person of a lady of indeterminate age, her hair radiantly ash blonde, her nails scarlet, her dress charming and expensive, printed silk, beating time to the music with her hand, a smile of pleasure on her pretty face, whilst the waitresses, obviously attracted to such a positive presence, hovered around her, offering her more cake, more tea. She bestowed a warm smile on them, and an even warmer one on the elderly pianist, who, when he got up and folded his music, came over to her and murmured something which made her laugh, then kissed her hand and left. His stiff, narrow back radiated with the appreciation he had received. Leaning back in her chair, her cup and saucer raised to her chin, this lady drank her tea with some delicacy, even with a sense of favourable presentation, and she did indeed make a delightful spectacle, devoid as she was of the anguish that attacks some people in strange places, and clearly at home in the ambience of the hotel, even if it was three quarters empty. Edith watched her as if under hypnosis, sorry to have missed a moment of this spectacle. Rings sparkled on the hand that brought a delicate lace handkerchief to her lips. When her tray had been taken away, Edith waited keenly to see what she would do with the hiatus between tea and dinner, so dispiriting to the unexpected or unaccompanied hotel guest. But of course this lady was not alone. "Here I am," carolled a young voice, and in the salon came a girl wearing rather tight white trousers, rather too tight, thought Edith, which outlined a bottom shaped like a large Victoria plum. "There you are, darling," cried the lady, who must be, her mother. "I've just finished. Have you had tea?" "No, but it doesn't matter," said the girl, who was, Edith saw, a rather paler version of her mother, or rather the same model of her mother, but not brought to the same state of high finish. "But my darling," exclaimed the older lady, You must have tea. You must be exhausted. Just ring the bell. They can make some more. As one of the waitresses approached, they both turned on her a winning smile, begging for tea, but with an assurance that it would certainly be forthcoming. And immediately, and then lapsed into an engrossed conversation of which Edith could only hear the odd word, together with the joyous and congratulatory spasms of laughter that escaped them both from time to time. When the second tray arrived, they both turned their smiling faces to the waitress, thanked her elusively, and resumed their dialogue, although the girl's lingering, as if her part in the ritual might just conceivably be prolonged. But that will be all, dear, said the lady in the silk dress, and settled down to contemplation of her daughter. The daughter must have been around 25, thought Edith, unmarried, but not worried about it. She is in no hurry, she could imagine the mother saying with a fine smile. She is quite happy as she is. And the daughter would blush and bridle, thus inviting lubricious speculations on the part of the elderly gentleman who would, Edith was sure, be in a relatively constant attendance on the mother. Oh, I must stop this, she said to herself. I do not have to make up their lives for them. They are, in fact, doing very nicely without me. And she felt a pang of wistfulness for such a mother, so good-humoured, so elegantly turned out, so insistent that her daughter should have tea, although it was nearly 6 o'clock. She felt a pang of wistfulness, too, for the daughter, so confident, so at ease with what was provided for her. And they were English, although not a type which she was familiar, and rather well off and having a good time. They looked as though they always did. At last they decided to make a move, and where the mother made two attempts to lever herself out the chair, her daughter hovering energetically beside her, as if knowing exactly when to intervene, Edith saw with some surprise that the older lady was in fact rather stiff in the joints, and that the shining impression of fairly youthful maturity, so impressive from a distance, was not prolonged when she stood up. Thoughtfully, she adjusted their ages, which she had put in the upper 50s and mid-20s, to the upper 60s and early 30s. But the appearance was excellent in both cases, and she was secretly very pleased when the older lady, opposite whom she had been seated, but at some distance, turned around and gave her a mild smile of acknowledgement before she left the room. Then there was nothing to do but go for a walk, through the silent garden, through an iron gate, across the busy road and along the shore of the lake. She walked in a faded light of that grey day. The silence engulfed her. Once she was past the town's one intersection, and it seemed as if she might walk forever, uninterrupted with her only thoughts for company. This solitude to which she had been banished by those who knew best was not what she had in mind, and this dim, veiled, discreet, but unfriendly weather, was this to be an additional accompaniment for this time of trial, for someone who had rashly travelled without a heavy coat? The lake was utterly still. A solitary lamp gleamed above her, turning the limp leaves of the plane trees to bright emerald. There is no need for me to stay here if I don't want to, she decided. Nobody is actually forcing me, but I must give it a try, if only to make things easier when I go home. The place is not totally unpopulated. I do need a rest. I could perhaps give it a week. And there is a lot to find out for someone of my benign persuasion, although, of course, none of those people would fit into the sort of fiction I write. But that very long, narrow woman, that beautiful woman with the tiresome dog, and more than that, that glamorous pair who seem to be so at ease here. Why are they here? But women, only women. I do so love the conversation of men. Oh, David, David, she thought. Her walk along the lake shore reminded her of nothing so much as those silent walks one takes in dreams, and in which unreason and inevitability go hand in hand. As in dreams, she felt both despair and a sort of doomed curiosity, as if she must pursue this path until its purpose were revealed to her. The cast of her mind that on this evening and the aspect of the path itself seemed to promise an unfavourable outcome. Shock, betrayal, or at this very least of train missed, an important occasion attended in rags, an appearance in the dock on an unknown charge. The light, too, was that of dreams, an uncertain penumbra surrounding this odd pilgrimage. Neither day nor night. In the real world, though, which she walked, she was aware of a certain physical characteristic. A perfectly straightforward gravel path flanked by two rows of trees standing in beaten earth. On one side, the lake, invisible now. On the other, presumably, the town. But a town so small and so well ordered that one would never hear the screaming of brakes or the hooting of horns or the noise of voices raised in extravagant farewells. Only the modest sound of a peaceful file of evening traffic going home faintly to her ears from somewhere beyond the trees, out of sight. Much louder was the sound of her own steps on the gravel, so loud that it seemed intrusive, and after a while she began to walk on the soft earth of the path near the lake. Beneath the light of an occasional lamp, she walked on uninterrupted, as if she were the only one abroad in this silent place. A perceptible chill rose from the water, which she could no longer see, and she shivered in her long cardigan. Doomed for a certain time to walk the earth, she thought, and brooding quite acquiescent, she carried on until she thought it time to be allowed to stop. Then she turned and retraced her steps. Walking back through the twilight, she saw the hotel from afar, lit up, falsely festive. I must make an effort, she decided, although she knew that a different sort of woman would have said, with a worldly sigh, I suppose I must put in an appearance. In the silent foyer, bright lights, a mumble from the television room, a smell of meat, she went up to change. At the desk, Monsieur Hubert, the elderly, retired but still active, benevolent and only mild intrusive, was enjoying his favourite moment of the day. He opened the register to see who had gone and who had arrived. Business was, of course, very slack at this time of year. The place was bound to be half empty in the month before the winter closure. The German family had gone, he noted. The noise of their going had indeed penetrated to his sitting room on the fifth floor. That curiously elderly couple from the Channel Island had left after tea. The conference at Geneva might yield the odd visitor, someone who decided to stay on, perhaps, or go back after the weekend. Otherwise, only the regulars were left. The Comtesse de Beneuil, Madame Pusey and her daughter, the woman with the dog, who he refused to name, although her husband was in the English Gotha, and as to whom his son-in-law had received his certain instructions. One new arrival. Hope. Edith. Joanna. An unusual name for an English lady. Perhaps not entirely English. Perhaps not entirely a lady. Recommended, of course. But in this business, one never knew.